This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It's the 31st of May and welcome to the show. You're with Julian Ng as well as Sharad Kutan. This is the 6 a.m. stretch, Sharad.
It is. And if you're not already out of bed and on the road, then I guess you're making your morning coffee, and as we do every morning. And I hope it perks you up. So we have lots lined up for today, aren't we?
I just wonder whether we can tell the listeners what, tell you guys out there, what it means. What does a 6 a.m. stretch mean? Because if you go to the BFM website, you can go there and download a lot of conversations at this hour of the day, 6 a.m. in the morning. But this is called the 6 a.m. stretch, and we have, you know, put our minds together to come up with this name.
Okay. So I guess there's no reason. It's not a trade secret. It's just that from 6 to 7, I guess, Julian, we're looking at a range of issues and trying to have discussions that perhaps a little less heavy on the business that, you know, follows from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock in earnest, right? So we have lots of very heavy business-orientated or sometimes politically-orientated news that we discuss. But between 6 and 7, we're picking up a whole range of stories, including issues that arise from work, arise from, you know, domestic situations and dynamics, and just things that stimulate your mind and get you kind of going for the day, I guess.
And on that note, you have the breakfast grill today with the Amnesty International.
Yeah, so the Secretary General of Amnesty International, Salil Shetty, is going to be on the grill, and he's in Kuala Lumpur because Amnesty International is one of the co-chairs of the World Economic Forum on ASEAN, which begins tomorrow and it goes on for 2 days. So it's Wednesday and Thursday this week. The World Economic Forum theme this year is shaping the ASEAN agenda for inclusion and growth. And so one of the questions I'm going to ask him is why Amnesty International, as a leading human rights organization, focus mainly on political rights, has come to be one of the co-chairs. I mean, if you think of ASEAN governments, they have almost by definition been hostile to the human rights agenda.
Yeah.
And, you know, and many of them are major violators and, you know, kind of up there in the pantheon of human rights violators. So why would they want, you know, an organization like Amnesty International?
Because this is not very, very interesting that Amnesty International is joining a dialogue with the World Economic Forum together with ASEAN, right?
Yeah, right. So, of course, it's not being organized by ASEAN, but I think it's kind of telling that human rights is part of the agenda and inclusion, because at least in this part of the world, growth cannot be spoken of without talking about inclusion. You want to kind of level everybody up because of the real problems of social instability that comes from increasing, income inequality and disparities in wealth and life chances. So,
and also for me, innovation. I mean, if you have very patriarchal, authoritative societies, whether ASEAN can move forward in coming up with the best products that they can offer. Because right now, a lot of these ASEAN members are thriving on low cost, right? Countries like Vietnam and Indonesia and so on, they're able to attract investments for their low cost regimes. But also sometimes in the case of Indonesia with their markets. But if they really want to compete in their own right in the global marketplace, whether they need dissent, and along with
and
it come
right.
in innovation.
Absolutely. You know, one of the three pillars, so they have what they call three pillars of the program. One is driving sustainable growth and social inclusion. I mentioned that just now. Mastering the fourth industrial revolution, which has to do with the term, you know, Industry 4.0, or the larger issue of the Internet of Things and such. And then, of course, there's strengthening regional relationships. So these are the three pillars that will make up the programs over those 2 days, tomorrow and the day after. But yes, you're absolutely right. So what does authoritarianism do to innovation? What happens to a society that cannot deal with difference? Can it be and likely to be an innovator? We see in this region, at least, Indonesia making really a leap forward beyond its kind of authoritarian past. You know, it's really embraced democracy in a big way. The Philippines remains largely democratic, I think. Thailand, which seemed to have turned, you know, many years ago, the corner on authoritarian rule, has slunk back. It's, you know, 2 years since the coup and no sight of a roadmap back to democracy, you know, with its junta-led, military junta-led government.
I'm also thinking about China, because they're also at the crossroads, but China has that population to harness. And they are right now at the forefront of internet and online innovation. So that's quite different from ASEAN, which are considered separately small countries. But
Yeah, I mean, the interesting about China, Julian, is that I think we all assume that just because there is a communist party there and that it's monolithic, that somehow the realities in the ground are similar, that everybody kind of walks in step with the communist party. I think, in fact, there's huge amounts of diversity in China. And if you watch just its films and its, you know, documentaries about real life in China, you will see quite a startling image of a country that really is going in many, many different directions at the same time. Very recently, there was a report about how China, the government has banned students from tearing up their textbooks. Did you read that one?
Right. I didn't read that.
Yeah, because kids get so frustrated or tense from their studies that they have taken to tearing their textbooks, and the government has banned it. I don't know if they can actually stop kids from acting out on, you know, on impulse, but, you know, communists or non-communists, you try to control kids, you're going to have a hard time.
Yeah, I think there are many things that kids do that can be banned. Just going to the World Economic Forum website, I mean, you talk about the fourth industrial revolution. I mean, what's the first, second, and third? The first industrial revolution used water and steam to power to mechanize production. The second used electric power to create mass production. The third industrial revolution used electronics and information technology to automate production. Now, with the fourth industrial revolution, is building on the third, which is a digital revolution that's been occurring since the middle of last century.
Yeah, so it's this kind of exponential leap into the world of, you know, of highly interconnected systems, right? Information flows, relationships, not just between robotics or machines talking to other machines, but of humans interacting with machines in a way that is symbiotic. You know, imagining the ability to plant monitors and sensors in just about everything in order to create more information. In fact, I was at a kind of roundtable discussion yesterday, Julian, sponsored by ABB, and they're kind of a giant in automation and stuff. And I was just amazed by the kind of factoids on the ground. I mean, what technological innovation, what direction it's going in, and just the huge leaps it's making and the exponential character of those changes as well. So the question is, can Malaysia harness, not just Malaysia, but the region? It's also interesting, there was somebody from the Federation of Malaysian Manufacturers talking about the reality on the ground for most manufacturers in Malaysia, not thinking of innovation as being a top priority, concerned about the cost of innovation despite the kinds of productivity gains or energy saving gains that are made, which are quite significant, apparently. Mm-hmm. And basically, some of the things that we don't even have on the ground. I mean, 60% of manufacturers, of factory owners, enterprise owners, saying they have no access to the internet, or, you know, very limited access to the internet. Things of that nature. So how are we going to, you know, parlay this, you know, fourth industrial revolution into something that will, you know, drive industry in the region? Very big question.
Talk about light discussions for the 6 a.m. hour.
No, this is just our
this
summary.
Is such a teaser.
Yeah, that's a teaser of the...
Well, it's a very multifaceted discussion, so don't forget to catch Salil Shetty, Secretary General of Amnesty International, on the Breakfast Grill at just after the 8 a.m. news. And at 8:30, you also have Current Affairs.
Yeah, so this is a discussion, very interesting one, about how The Human Rights Commission of Malaysia, or Suhakam, highlighted recently the outcome of a groundbreaking complaint against the project developer Mega First Corporation Berhad, the first of its kind, concerning the human rights impact of a Malaysian company's operations abroad. And so I believe Nadia Abdulaziz speaks to Tanja Venisnik from Earth Rights International, explains what's happening with this hydroelectric initiative called Dong Shao Shong, or Dong Sa Hong, on the Mekong River. So it's a transboundary issue. Sorry, lots of foreign words here, names. Quite get my tongue around. So yeah, that's going to be interesting. That's at 8:30, and perhaps also speaks to the kinds of real challenges that are going to be faced for the region, you know, as it gets increasingly integrated. You know, we've had, of course, you know, the transboundary pollution problem. You know, can Singaporeans who suffer from the ill effects of practices in another country actually take those individuals and corporations to court for what's happening? Because, you know, the I think the cost of the haze in Singapore, never mind in Malaysia, because Malaysia doesn't have that kind of legislation. I think Singapore really pressed ahead with legislation that allowed it to punish people for acts committed beyond its jurisdiction. Now, that's quite an important step in really getting the region to think collectively about what is happening, especially with transboundary issues. Here we have a question of human rights as well, and the impact on local communities by operations of Malaysian companies.
Well, it's going to be an hour that looks like it's going to be filled by interviews with NGOs, and that's not a bad thing. Also, on the BBC show today at 9:30 a.m., we will be talking about a city that has turned itself around. This is in Tennessee, America, in a place called Chattanooga. It was once referred to as the dirtiest city in America, and today it's gone into high-tech innovation and enterprise, very much related to the kind of stuff that we're discussing today, Sharad. In 2010, this city became the first in America to enjoy gigabit internet speed. That's really, really fast speed, following an investment of a couple of $100 million from its publicly owned electricity company, EPB. So this is like their version of Tanaga National bestowing upon that city the you know, the kind of innovation at cutting edge internet speed and how it has turned the city around. So catch that on the BBC show today at 9:30 a.m.
Well, you know, that's Chattanooga, of course, reminds me of a song from a time before I was born, actually.
Okay, history lesson here.
No, it's just Chattanooga Choo Choo. I don't know if we have it. We could play it. We probably couldn't. We could try it. See if
we'll
we can
look
find
for
Chattanooga.
It. We'll look, rummage through the old record.
We're gesturing
record
to Timothy
shelves.
There, who's behind the panels, desperately looking for Chattanooga Choo Choo. We have it on the playlist.
Okay, let's look at some news. Rafizi Ramli has finally lodged a report with the MACC, or the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, on allegations regarding the graft and request for women case in the Selangor state government.
Yeah, we interviewed Rafizi last week and a video was uploaded under our Uncensored series. So if you go to our Facebook page, you can listen to it. It's just, or watch it rather. It's about 3 minutes long. It's already gathered more than 13,000 views. And I think it's generated also a lot of conversation about exactly what Rafizi means by doing this, and the kinds of, you know, issues that he puts forward, including, you know, whether an act is illegal or just unethical maybe politically, politically incorrect, if you like. The idea is that, you know, there might be things that can be done but shouldn't be done by a political party that holds itself up to a kind of higher ethical standards. So these are kind of discussions that are coming around that video. So you can go to our Facebook page, BFM Radio, and you can have a look at that video.
Okay, and also not surprisingly, because of this report, there is now a growing rift within PKR's ranks, because this report is against the Selangor state government, and newspapers have come up with such reports of growing rifts. Also, some resignations with Talent Corp. Johan Merican is no longer the chief there. He is replaced by Shireen Sharitza, Dato Abdul Ghani. And in Singapore, also, the beleaguered Noble Group CEO resigned there again for family reasons. We'll be back with more news after this. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Come Together by Joe Cocker. And now, you know, Sharad, we have been following fads and trends, not we personally, but following the news.
Oh, dude,
of fad and trends, you know, hipsters all over the places. One of the things that has been in, I guess, the lexicon of healthy people over the past few years is this thing called quinoa. And The Economist recently ran an article about why it has become a fad. And it's been really become a global phenomenon and has made some poor farmers in the Andean pretty rich.
Yeah, so actually one of the things that I always find a difficulty is actually pronouncing the word. So is it quinoa or is it quinoa?
Wait, I think it's quinoa. Quinoa, right? Quinoa.
Quinoa, that's right. I think that's what it is. But of course, again, it's one of those grains like millet that's grown or can be grown in very harsh conditions. But it became a fad, you're right. And global demand actually drove up prices to a great extent. And what happened was, at that point, there was a discussion, and The Guardian apparently had a discussion about this and saying, well, you know, there's so much poverty and malnourishment in that part of South America, and this is just going to price out locals from actually consuming the food they're producing. And that apparently was not true. So studies showed that Andean farmers actually didn't spend that much money or their wages on quinoa, or quinoa rather. And what had happened was they instead grew rich from the trade, and there was a kind of spillover effect. So all in all, it was a good story. Unfortunately, because global demand was so great and this fad was such a rage that everybody, including the big boys in agriculture, wanted to get in on the act and get in on the profits. That, of course, led to prices plummeting, you know, by 40% in 2014. So the last 2 years have been very tough for Andean farmers. The question now is, you know, if you're a consumer of these fads, what do you pick? Now, just to give you an example, why the kind of field is kind of uneven. Apparently, it takes an ox, which is what an Andean farmer would use, 6 days to plow a field that a tractor, which the big boys use, what a tractor can do in 2 hours. Right, so the difference is stark, and as a consequence, the prices of quinoa coming from the kind of Andean farms in done in the old way is about $2.60 USD, compared to a market price now of less than $2. If you are, you know, a health food freak, and because quinoa apparently it's one of the richest food sources that we know on the globe, it's not complete because no food is complete, but it is the closest we come to something like a complete food. Would you pay, Julian? And I know you're very concerned about health, and I know you're very picky about your food.
I'm also concerned about poor farmers.
Okay. So would you pay the fair price,
So going back to, first of all, the kind of nutritional properties that quinoa has, it offers a decent helping of protein. It's also pretty carb-intensive, but it's actually gluten-free. So that would appeal to that big gluten-free fad that's going on right now. It contains some protein substance, but it has been known to cause some digestive reactions in some people. But
you mean like bloating and such? Things we cannot mention on radio.
Yes, things like that. Fair trade, I think this is very hard to regulate because we just buy whatever we think is cheaper, especially when you think that, when you consider the fact that our incomes are also affected, right? We've got a very difficult situation here in Malaysia with the ringgit going down, making everything a lot more expensive. So we're driven by a kind of mercenary attitude where we go the path of least resistance and buy the cheapest product. So that is the path that we would naturally follow. But whether that's the right thing or not, I don't know. And I think that a lot of food policies that we have make things very difficult. Like, for example, we want to put palm oil into our cars, right? And I don't know whether that's a good thing or not, because that only has the effects of making food prices more expensive.
Okay, well, you know, in your food basket for a month, right, how much would the quinoa be in terms of the amount, right? You're going to be buying, you know, even if you bought the fair trade priced quinoa, chances are you're not going to be spending in absolute terms that much more money. Though the difference between that and the, you know, the cheaper versions made in, you know, in various other countries, will be, as you say, attractive because it's cheaper. But weren't you ever seduced into buying foods that came from the frontline states, during the dark days of the apartheid regime, the anti-apartheid campaign? There were, you could buy coffee from the frontline states. Do you remember this? I mean, you may be too young, Julian. No, You're only 2 years younger than myself, but okay.
I hadn't started even drinking coffee at that time.
But there were things like that, right? So basically consuming food with a political cause. And, and I think that's an interesting thing. And people, awareness could be raised among a lot of people about that too, right? So you go looking for it. Now, having read the article in The Economist, I'm likely to think myself as, one, I want to buy quinoa because it's nutritious. Two, I'd be looking for where it comes from. And if it comes from some Andean country, a state, I probably would choose that over there, because I'm very holier than thou that way. No, I'm not. But you know what I mean. It's.
You sound like it.
Because I'm not going to be eating quinoa every day.
No,
I'm
but gonna be I don't have quinoa in my diet, but I do buy a lot of things which I consider healthy, like farm eggs and, ethically raised chickens and so on. And I kind of try to shift my budgets from spending less on the stuff that are more unhealthy, and I'm buying some of this healthy stuff. But those things are not necessarily from poor farmers, right? The healthily raised chicken or farm eggs are possibly from rich farmers as well. So, and I think this is such a tough situation, because it involves trans-boundary governmental efforts. Quinoa in South America and consumers the rest of the world, you don't have a supranational government regulating this. So what do you do? And I think that the local government themselves should give more support to these farmers and should organize their farming a little bit more, give them some subsidies. For want of a better solution, that could be it.
Yeah, or it could be in the way you market it, right? So the way The Economist frames it is that what you'll see is a push for this, what they call heirloom quinoa, right? So the idea is that it's grown in a traditional fashion, and that becomes its marketing strategy.
A premium product.
Right?
It becomes a premium product.
Right.
Now, I went to Morocco, and there is a surfeit of craft being sold there. You can literally ask for the price that you want, and if they don't offer it to you, you could walk away, right? And then they'll beg you to come back with giving you the price that you want. But there are these cooperatives that act on behalf of the artisans. But I don't know how it will work, because there's just too much supply out there, and the artisans that go under the cooperatives would find themselves in a situation where there is not enough demand there, because you can get it for the cheaper price next door, right, with the non-cooperative guy. So it's something that is really hard to solve, and I think this is where we really need to, it's a bigger issue. We need to think think about a living wage or something like that to supplement farmers who are down and out?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was in Sri Lanka recently, and the fair trade, cooperative that sold, very interesting fabrics, some beautiful designs, but they were like twice the cost of what you could get at it. Upmarket, store. And so it was like, wow, the pricing seems so out of whack with the market. But you're right. And is a sense of charity enough to sustain, a business like that?
You're listening to the 6 a.m. stretch where we talk about stories that are not necessarily related to the heavy stuff that we talk about usually at the 7.
Wait till you hear what Julian has picked to talk about next.
Yes, it's all about capitalism and socialism.
Right. I don't know whether, so it's not heavy.
It's
the light stuff.
Light conversation when you've just woken up. And now, have you guys, I'm sure you've been following the Bernie Sanders phenomenon in the United States. I mean, he's the Democratic presidential nominee, and he has basically changed the agenda and conversation within the Democratic Party because he is one of the first politicians in coming out of the United States that have been unabashed in calling himself a socialist Democrat for a long time. And that had been a dirty word in the U.S. for a very, very long time. And according to a recent poll conducted by the Harvard Institute of Politics, 19% of young Americans only 19% of young Americans identify themselves as capitalists. And in America as a whole, only 42% called themselves capitalists and supported capitalism. That's a low number by American standards, whereas only 26% really supported capitalism. So a lot more of the young people and the millennials who go out there and vote for Bernie Sanders in the current primaries that are going on did not mind the label socialist. And this is a big turnaround in American society.
You know, there's a brilliant book by a British historian called Tony Judd titled Ill Fares the Land, where he tries to make a case for not socialism, of the Cuban variety or socialism of the Chinese or Soviet variety, but for social democracy. The idea that a society, even with the engine of growth being capitalism, must find ways of equalizing opportunities, cross-subsidizing services, and a whole range of other strategies to bring everybody together as society progresses. So he makes a case for democratic socialism, or rather social democracy. Democratic socialism is another thing. And it's a brilliant book, but it begins by trying to understand why the question of socialism is so difficult for Americans at this point in time, because it was not true. There was a Communist Party of America. It wasn't always true. There was a Communist Party of America. There was a very strong left tendency in American politics as well. We had Americans, the radicals, you can think of the number of academic Marxists in America and such. But
there was that
mainstream
witch
America.
There was that witch hunt in the 60s
That
demonized the word socialism or communism, which is usually linked to communism. I don't think they are the same things, but since that time, they had been bad words. But unbeknownst to many Americans, because I guess of the bad press, FDR during the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt, after the Great Depression of the 30s, he came out with a New Deal, and that was effectively a kind of a socialist agenda that saw the greatest prosperous period America has seen since that time. And since the 70s, a lot of politicians, especially from the Republican side, set to reverse this through the reduction of corporate and taxes for the rich people. And now, I guess because of the poor economic situation over there, many Americans feel disenfranchised. And I guess this appeals, the idea of socialism is again appealing to many.
Yeah, so we tweeted out the link to that story coming from Time magazine. But, you brought up the question of communism. And I think a lot of people, when they hear the word communism, they think of the political dimension of communism, meaning a one-party state. And the political dominance of that one party over society. But the economic corollary to that is, of course, the command economy. So when we talk about communism and systems, economic systems, we're talking about a command economy. And that's really the question that's posed to us. Are, social democrats or democratic socialists, whatever you might call them, essentially those who are advocates and supporters of capitalism, but capitalism that is regulated, that is constrained, for which it's in the worst aspects of the system ameliorated so that people don't suffer as much, right? So that's the idea.
Then it's just socialism is just all about giving a helping hand to someone who's down and out, right? For example, the Andean farmers.
No. That's not so. Some people say, well, that's not socialism. That's just charity. And being charitable doesn't make you a socialist. So the question is, what is, in a kind of thoroughgoing sense, socialism would refer to really reorganizing the means of production, reorganizing the relationship that workers have to how they work and how they earn a living or how do they reproduce themselves in the world.
I think
that is a thoroughgoing socialism. Socialism is not just being about being nice.
Well, I think the meaning is changing because people are adopting the meaning according to their own situation. And in America, for a big part of them, I mean, inequality is rising. There is a plutocracy going on where the world is ruled by the 1% of the 1%, so the richest people in the world. And socialism has become doing something that is fair to the other guy. And so this guy, Bernie Sanders, he's going with that kind of thinking, and he's saying, you got to pay more taxes because I want to spend $20 trillion over the next decade providing free education and free healthcare. And that's what a lot of the young people want because they are down and out. They're still living with their parents.
If you remember, cast your mind back to the 80s when Ronald Reagan ruled on one side of the Atlantic and Margaret Thatcher the other. And her form of conservatism, right? Her party's stand was a very harsh kind of look at society. In fact, she famously said, "What is this thing you call society?" She refused to acknowledge something like society. There was a market, there were families, there were individuals. There wasn't something like society. And it wasn't the business of government to play at being, compassionate. But, at some point, there was a real crisis with Thatcherism. And now the conservatives in Britain talk about compassionate conservatism, right? The idea that conservatism can have a human face, just like in the past, socialism and communism, also put on a human face, right? The command economy and authoritarian rule seem to, in different parts of the Soviet bloc, adopted this idea of socialism with a human face. So again, we come back to the question of definitions. What is it that young Americans mean when they say they're socialists? What is it that they will entertain in terms of state intervention, control of the economy, regulation and such?
I think that there's also a problem of English, right? Because America and the UK are great influences because a big part of the world speak English. And whenever they come up with an idea, it kind of bites because people only listen to them. It's their greatest export. But if you look at the Nordic countries, the Scandinavian countries, and if you look at the latest happiness index, they are today some of the happiest countries in the world. They have been practicing socialism, social democracy for a long time. And Denmark, for example, they pride themselves as people who are also at the same time very good in doing business. And in spite of that, they are a kind of social democracy. They pay high taxes and using those taxes to help each other out. One of the most educated societies in the world.
2 years ago, Julian, I was on a U.S. State Department sponsored reporting tour, which meant that I was together with 40 other journalists from around the world in the U.S. To watch the first presidential debate of that race, the one that Obama eventually won against Mitt Romney. And we met with Americans, and I was shocked by how low they were, some of them anyway. I remember one man saying to me, "Well, if you start giving student loans out, the next step is totalitarianism." And I said, "Well, before you get to Russia, maybe you can think of the Nordic countries." And it was this this is an ideological commitment to refusing to see a middle ground, refusing to see that there's something between, you know, the current situation and this totalitarian vision that some people have. You know, they even said to me they prefer gridlock to a strong presidency. Mm-hmm. You know, they hated Obama.
I want to go back to quickly to your farmer story, because people are not buying their quinoa for cheaper ones, and now there's another group that's complaining, the capitalists, the home sellers, complaining that millennials are no longer buying homes because they place more importance on experiences. Sharad, what's your view, your quick view on that?
I think it's a nice corrective to the never-ending chase for things. Experiences are, I guess, the last things you remember when you end your life. In fact, it's been said that people don't remember what they bought at the end of their lives. They remember the relationships they had. Yeah. And that's, I guess, the most important thing, because you can't really bring your things. Well, I don't know. I don't believe in an afterlife, but I don't think you can take your things anywhere.
Yeah, but to me, it's really nice to juxtapose the two groups. One, capitalists not being able to sell homes, and the other, farmers not being able to sell their produce. I think this is a conversation that would continue on. And after the 7 o'clock news, we will also have a conversation about what went on in the global markets yesterday. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.